Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It's a podcast edition of the monthly Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio in Colorado and the Boulder Bookstore. And today visiting us in the book club is Gary Ferguson, whose latest book is Land on Fire, The New Reality of Wildfire in the West. And as we heard in the book club edition of the show, it really is a new reality. And people are living with a new mindset, it seems, in states like Colorado, Arizona, California, and all of these states that have been seeing an increase in wildfires, an increase in the size and the intensity of wildfires. Is there a mental health impact on this? Is there a certain anxiety that we're now just living with as a matter of consequence of living in this area?
Well, I'm not a psychologist, but psychologists who I know say there is indeed. It's a low level of stress and sometimes trauma. I know where I am in Montana, Red Lodge, Montana. We, this time of year, start walking out the front door and sniffing the air for smoke. And if we smell it, then when we go downtown to get our mail at the post office, we look at the flag on the top of the post office and see if it's blowing, from what direction, how hard. And there is a lot of anxiety. We know up there, like you do around here, there are canyons and areas that have big fuel loads, and if lightning happens to strike or somebody carelessly starts a fire and the wind's out of the wrong direction, it could threaten the entire town, actually.
Yeah, I got anxious the other night. We've had a series of 90-degree days here in Boulder, and then suddenly I heard some thunder, and then there's lightning. And it did end up raining that night, but for a little while, there's 5 or 10 minutes there where it seemed like we were having thunder and lightning and no rain.
Oh,
after
yes,
a series
right.
of 90-degree days,
sure.
you can start getting worried.
Yeah,
you know?
You do, and it's
you can't enjoy the lightning anymore. You know, you can't, like this.
I mean, yeah, I don't know what the solution to that is. I mean, there needs to be some way for us to maintain mental health in the face of this kind of stress, because this is not going away. This is what we're looking at for the next probably century at least, and maybe beyond. So we do need to find a way to keep our wits about us in the face of these potential catastrophes.
I often wonder, is social media playing a role in this? Because it's really played a role in how a lot of these natural disasters are being reported, and then how information is being communicated. I mean, you're often now going to get information on Twitter.
Yeah.
Someone sends a tweet out smelling smoke in, you know, name a canyon or whatever, and next thing everyone kind of freaks out. So it's a double-edged thing. In one way, it's a great way to get immediate information out there, but at the same time, it's a great way to freak yourself out on a permanent basis.
Yeah, maybe that would be a good first step, is to just really measure your social media and where you turn to for facts. If you can find a good source, just stick with that and don't get too caught up in the panic and paranoia of it all.
As always, humans are paying more attention to wildfire, which has been, you know, part of natural environment for forever. We're paying attention to it now because it's really impacting us, because more and more people are living in these areas that are burning,
yeah,
the wildlife-urban interface. But in terms of the human impact, you have a whole chapter profiling firefighters. And throughout your entire book, Land on Fire, you have this kind of hypothetical fire that could be burning in, you know, southern Colorado, and you have the plane that goes over and you imagine all the different fires. And you imagine the command response, you know, and what happens with the firefighters and the protocol that they follow. These are highly trained people, and very often the people on the front lines are people in the communities themselves, and often are volunteers, certainly here locally. And I
yes.
remember the big fire here in 2010 on Labor Day, where I think a couple of hundred houses were lost in Boulder County. Some of the houses that were lost belonged to the firefighters themselves, and they knew that as they were in protecting other people's houses. And talk a little bit more about the mindset of someone who puts themselves on the front line of fighting these fires in their own communities, but then often end up in other places, like some of the hotshot crews travel around the region to fight fires wherever they're needed.
Well, the firefighters I know and hang out with are really into service. They do believe that the job they're performing is one that's essential to the welfare of their community, and they're very community-invested people, and they get to express that concern through their jobs. They also, some of them are somewhat adrenaline junkies. You know, they love to go in and work hard and be in dangerous situations, and not that they're cavalier about it at all, but they do get a certain rush out of working that hard. A lot of them don't work necessarily as hard in the winter, so they can work incredibly difficult jobs for 6 months or 7 months and then kick back and ski or whatever else they want to do and travel to Mexico. And so it fits their lifestyle. But the first thing I would say is they're very committed to being professionals in service of the welfare of the community. You know, if a fire starts out here, it will probably be a local incident commander of some rank from Boulder who will go up and take a look at it. And then have all this thing, all these things in her head. You know, she'll know what the wind speed is, what the weather forecast is, what the fuel moisture is, how many down trees there are within several hundred yards of that fire. It's amazing what she'll have to have in her head. And based on all of that, then she'll start calling in the resources appropriate to what level of fire she determines it to be. And from there on, it's really like mounting a military operation. It's very precise. Everybody knows where everything is staged, who's in charge of what, who gives the orders, the communication lines, the interagency working together, the interagency techniques for communicating Forest Service to Park Service to local fire departments, all of that communication, that's all been sussed out so that it's incredibly efficient. And that's the good news. We do live at a time when firefighting has never been more effective.
I experienced that myself as a news reporter covering some of the local fires, and you can really see how the communication kicks into gear, and then automatically it seems to just be a system that's ready in place, ready to go. And then if a fire gets to a certain point, that's when maybe federal or state level incident command comes in and takes over, but very much with the cooperation, obviously, of the local fire department. I'm glad you mentioned she is a hypothetical incident commander, because there are quite a few women who are involved in this.
Absolutely. And at my reading at Boulder Bookstore the other night, there were two women firefighters who had been doing it quite a while. They're every bit as tough as the men. And they do, I've asked them about this, they do have to work even harder sometimes to prove themselves. This is, whether we like to admit it or not, still somewhat of a patriarchy, a male-dominated system, the whole society, and certainly firefighting can sometimes be that way. And so she said, the woman I talked to the other night at the Boulder Bookstore, not only the women, but people of color as well, they'll tend to work a lot harder to prove themselves as being capable and competent. And as a result, it's often women or people of color who end up with heat exhaustion and other things because they're pushing themselves just a little bit harder than they should for health, for good health.
I mean, what is the physical reality of going in, being on the front line of something like that, if you're in a hotshot crew, the temperatures you're experiencing, in addition to the equipment that you have to wear and the physical exercise that you have to do as well?
Well, you've got a big, what's called a ready pack, sitting by your front door, and a radio on your hip if you're on call all the time. And so the radio will call out a fire alert, and you will immediately grab your ready pack, go out to the airport or wherever it is your predetermined destination is to meet your fellow firefighters. If it's a hotshot crew, it'll often be an airport because you're going to be flown in by helicopter to get to the fire as quickly as you can. You're going to have Nomax fire retardant clothing on, which is quite hot but quite effective in resisting sparks and heat. By the time you get close to the fire, it depends on the situation, but you're going to be often in well over 100 degree temperatures, so dehydration is a constant worry. And then when you're putting out that effort that equates to about 6,000 calories a day, the amount of food that you have with you in your pack, and then you'll be resupplied. But when you go out, you've got usually a day and a half or 2 days worth of food and water and everything else just in case resupply can't get to you for some reason. So that's a tremendous amount of weight. We're talking often 80, 90, 100-pound packs, and that's an awful lot to schlep up sometimes a trailless bit of forested mountain to get to the front of a fire line.
More effective than the Jane Fonda workout, would you say?
I would say it's extraordinarily more effective, yes.
One of the parts of the book I like is you have this yellow page, and it's about 10 standard firefighting orders, 18 watch-out situations. These are things that the firefighters carry, you know, yes, at all times. And they're very serious things. Sometimes they'll say, you know, 18 watch-out situations. One might be safety zones and escape routes not identified, or instructions and assignments not clear. What could cause a danger that you could get caught in? But I love number 18. All these serious things. Number 18 is taking a nap near the fire line. And that must be because people get so exhausted, right?
Exactly, Arson. That's precisely. And that has happened.
Because it's not like nap time in kindergarten. These people are just dropping to sleep. They're so exhausted,
They're dropping to sleep. That's exactly right. And it has resulted in death before. Somebody is so exhausted they fall asleep, and they usually from smoke inhalation. They'll die.
It's just crazy.
Yeah, it really is. It's extraordinary.
Well, let's talk about the photos in the book. There are extraordinary photos throughout the entire book. Arson, you kind of described it almost like fire porn. There's a certain titillation to see them.
Well, there's some pictures, and you mentioned the photographer who's a firefighter, that these trees bursting in these magnificent orange flames, and some of them almost look like pictures that are abstract paintings. The orange is so beautiful, and your eye just can't look away from them. And it's like fire in real life. if you're sitting around the campfire, or if you're sitting, I think there is a certain attraction to fire. For all this anxiety and fear about it, there's also a natural human attraction that sometimes turns unhealthy. Also, you mentioned, besides for the fire porn in this book, there are 10,000 fires a year are set intentionally.
Yeah,
so
that's
some
right,
people
that's
are really
right.
attracted to it. But
you know, I do think fire is, of all the forces out there, the most primal. It's in our bones. It's in our genes. We know it as a terrifying thing, but we also know it as the force of nature that unlocked almost everything to make life doable and comfortable for human beings. I mean, the food we eat, the automobiles we drive, the jets, the lights, everything is really one way or another related to that primal fire spark. And so I do think there's a tremendous psychological appeal to fire, even though it can be terrifying at the same time.
But yeah, you see in the pictures, like Maeve said, my wife said, don't mention fire porn. But I said, okay, we can do it on the podcast. But it really is. I found myself just so attracted to the pictures in an amazing way. And it's just, it is this dual thing. Like what you said with, you know, without fire, you couldn't talk about 6,000 calories a day. I mean, human beings would be nothing. We would just be looking for enough calories per day.
Yeah.
If there wasn't cooking, if there wasn't fire.
That's true. That's true. And you know, I've done a lot of work with nature mythology, going back as far as we can go, and the number of stories that have to do with fire, animals bringing fire to humans, or the phoenix rising from the ashes. You know, when we see a fire burning, it's not lost on us that this is a devastating clearing out of the old, basically to make way for something else to be created, a destruction and creation in the way that gods and goddesses have been described across human history for, you know, as long as we know.
I mean, there's something almost biblical, actually, you know, to that end of some of the reality that we're in now with wildfire. And it's just this, as you said, nature clearing everything out. Now, the unfortunate thing is more and more people are living in areas of nature that maybe we shouldn't be there. So in terms of who is living where, how they're impacted by fire, but really the impact then on wider community. I mean, I know after some of the major fires here, the Black Forest Fire in Colorado Springs and some of the fires that happened in Boulder County and the Hayman Fire, the state sees insurance rates go up for everyone because this is just the consequence. We see it after hailstorms as well, and we see it after flood. And yet some people are choosing to live in areas where they're more at risk, and that ultimately it's more costly for society. Alongside that, that's in regions that in the Western US that typically have had this very robust sense of individualism.
Yes.
You know, it's the rugged individual living in the Mountain West, and I get to live in the forest. And, you know, obviously I'm, you know, doing a stereotype here. And so what is the kind of the, how do those two things align when you have an entire society almost has to pay for certain people to live there when it comes to fighting fires and to make it safe to live in these areas? And yet everyone is paying for that, and yet only certain people get to live there. I mean, what are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, it's a difficult question, but I do think that there's a reasonable expectation that if you're going to live in a very high-risk fire zone and the insurance is more costly because of that choice, then you ought to bear some of the responsibility for that additional cost and not be spreading it out to people who have nothing to do with that particular area, nor the money to help subsidize that decision for you. The other thing, though, I think insurance companies would be well advised to do, and too few are doing it, is go the other direction. Give insurance discounts for people who live in fire-prone areas who take these very simple mitigation measures to protect their homes. You mentioned the Black Forest Fire. One subdivision there where there had been no mitigation effort at all. It was really just business as usual since the subdivision had started back in the 1930s. They lost 61 out of 67 houses. Right next door was Cathedral Pines. They made it a priority to make sure that everybody's house had been tended and the grounds kept and the woods around the community thinned. They lost 4 houses. So it's a tremendous difference. And insurance companies perhaps would be well advised to start funding those kinds of projects too. Rally communities, hire whatever leadership they need to help communities safeguard their houses. I think that kind of long-term vision is going to be essential if these insurance companies are going to stay afloat in this kind of loss.
Well, aside from the insurance and maybe to incentivize people to do fire mitigation, what about punishing people who don't? I mean, are there laws in place where if you do not create, if you don't do adequate fire mitigation on your property, because it's not just about you, you're impacting other people as well. Because if your fire, if your house goes up, you're likely then to have your neighbour's house go up. I mean, just the logistics of how fire spreads.
That's a wonderful question. As far as I know, there are no penalties for you not taking care of your home. There could be public shaming by your neighbors. And some of this, you know, the urban wildland urban interface is developing right now at a rate of about 4,000 acres a day. That's how fast we're building in it. A lot of counties, now Boulder would not be among them, but a lot of counties don't really even enforce the most basic fire standards at the county commissioner level when a development goes in. So if you only have one way in and out of the subdivision, that may be just fine. If you don't really have adequate water supply for the firefighters who might have to fight structural fires there, that may be just fine. It's part of that kind of, you know, fierce independence that you were talking about earlier. So as far as I know, there are no consequences in many places anyway for not doing the right thing. And it's unfortunate. And probably at some point very soon, some insurance companies are going to simply refuse to write. In fact, I think this is already happening in many communities. They're just no longer writing policies in certain areas because they just think the loss is too inevitable.
You know, it reminds me a lot. I grew up on the East Coast, and we would go to the beach in New Jersey, the beach in Delaware, down in Florida, and people are building all those barrier islands, which had traditionally not been built on. And those islands are islands that move. The sand goes from one end to the other, and over time, if there was nothing on those islands, they would move up the coast. They would change shape. They're not permanent land masses. And so when you put a permanent structure in a place like that, you know, you're always fighting nature to keep it there.
Yes, yes.
And I feel when I read your book, I felt the same way about some of this. It's an endless fight. You know, when you build in this area and maybe you can mitigate for this fire or mitigate for that fire, but it just seems like we shouldn't be there to some extent, you know, and you're just fighting the inevitable.
And this brings up a point that is so dear to my heart. We are coming off of centuries of hubris when it comes to human beings and nature. It's human beings versus nature. I mean, the beginnings of science with Descartes and Bacon, their whole goal initially was to disenchant nature. We were going to prove that we were the superior species and reveal God's handiwork and design and his lessons for us. And, you know, we would take control of nature. Our overconfidence and our hubris has gotten us into so much trouble. And if we're ever going to get on top of anything as complex as climate change, we're going to have to get humble in the face of how we behave. We've got all the intellectual capacity we need. We've got the technology to know how to live smartly and sustainably, but we need the will, we need the heart, and we need to elect people to do that.
Do you see any evidence of that, though? I mean, to be honest, I mean, it's easy to be depressed now, but yeah. I mean, it just doesn't seem like there's any real will. And even if there's some will politically, you know, individually there's not. People want to live on either a barrier island on the East Coast, or they want to live in the mountains here, you know, with a bunch of trees around them.
Well, I think ultimately what I said earlier about insurance companies maybe even refusing to insure, then you're going to probably just have those areas occupied by people who have enough money that if they lose their house, they'll build another one. So it will make a class system. Nature will become the province of the wealthy, and that's happened elsewhere in the world, and it could happen here again easily.
Yeah. There's a hypothetical fire running throughout your entire book where you imagine, well, you know, if there's a lightning strike and we're flying a plane over and we see, you know, the impact of the fire, and then we have this hypothetical incident command and what would happen there. The last chapter of your book is future fire. Where is all of this going? Because we're already living through it. We're already in a state where a lot of people, as we talked about at the beginning, are in a heightened sense of anxiety because we seem to be in an expanded, at least, fire season. It's not just the summer months. It's nearly half the year at this point. And we're often seeing smaller fires in winter as well. Where is all of this going, and how soon are we going to see it get even worse?
Well, it's going to get worse before it gets better, no question about it. Just as a sobering statistic, last year, in 2016, the state of California lost 60 million trees due to drought and drought-related insect infestation. 60 million trees, they'll stand up for about 8 years, then winds will blow them down, and they'll create a fuel load, you know, to rival anything we've got going right now. So there will be mega fires after mega fires. We've certainly are on track for increased warming. We've had five of the hottest years on the planet since 2000. The last three were 2014, 2015, 2016. That kind of trend will continue and make fires worse because the humidity will drop in the forest. What will eventually happen is forests will be cleaned out through these processes, and they will grow back in more healthy fashion. And hopefully the next time around, we'll be able to let the stand maintenance fires burn through and keep them cleaned out. But it's going to be a lot of loss and a lot of panic and a lot of anxiety before we get to that point.
And have we learned the lessons of the last 100 years or more of forest mismanagement, where fire suppression was the ethos and there wasn't enough fire mitigation done?
I think the people who work in the agencies responsible for managing the forest absolutely get it. No question about it. They do run across, sometimes if they go to do a prescribed burn, well, if the community 20 miles away hears about it, and they, of course, hear about it because they're notified ahead of time, some people don't like the thought that smoke's going to be in the air and that they would have to breathe the smoke. So now they've got these very sophisticated computer models being developed to try as much as possible, predict just exactly the right days to do these burns, and that's when they're starting them. But so we know what to do, but we do have to come up against the fact that not everybody is a big fan of some of our treatment options, to go in and thin the forest. Sometimes that will take roads, and sometimes that will take getting in and actually commercially harvesting timber, and some people won't like that. But if we really want to take these fires seriously, we're going to have to change our ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think you talk about climate change. I mean, these forest fires, you're losing 60 million trees gone. That's a carbon sink, where they could go into. Now you don't have that.
That's right.
And all the smoke going into the air causes other, makes climate change that much worse. I mean, so it seems like we're getting a little too far into a cycle that...
Yes, kind of a self-reinforcing cycle.
Yes.
One very optimistic, at least, start I would suggest people do is go to the Boulder Bookstore and pick up Paul Hawkins' Drawdown. It's a combination of things that communities and individuals can do that will really, really, truly make a difference. Whether we'll have the political will or the financial will to do these things, I don't know. But I found it a very heartening book based on the best science in the world that does let us know, okay, of the grand scheme of things, what should we be putting our energies and our dollars to right now to make a difference in the best way possible?
Well, and in terms of tips, you offer many in your book as well around protecting your property and things you can do. And as you mentioned there in the Black Forest Fire in Colorado Springs, when you actually have that community-wide fire mitigation, it does make a difference even in the advent of these massive big fires.
It does. And people tend to think that fires just roll in and the communities are destroyed in walls of flame. That's almost never how it happens. In fact, I don't know of a single incident where that's happened. It happens because of spotting. Embers leaving the main fire and landing on somebody's roof. And then if the houses are too close, one ignites the other, So it's not the kind of dire fighting against a wall of fire that people think it is. It's just simply preventing that ember from starting a fire. And that's pretty simple to do.
Well, Arson, you live in downtown Boulder. Are you going to go home and chop down a couple of trees in your yard now?
Well, we're in a condo and we don't have too many trees. But it's been a good conversation because I feel a little, I don't feel quite as panicked now. I think that the local fire people are watching. And, hopefully these embers won't come into downtown Boulder. But it is scary when you get put on evacuation alert, which has happened a few times in the last couple of years now.
Sure. Yeah, that's scary. I've been on that myself a few times. Everything by the front door ready to load into the car and drive away. Yeah, it's not a good way to live.
But we're just waiting on the locusts to show up. We've had the fire. We've had the flood. I guess we've had the pine beetles. We have some kind of insect.
Yeah, it's a full house.
Well, people can read more about Gary Ferguson's book, Land on Fire, The New Reality of Wildfire in the West. And you can hear the book club edition of the interview at news.kgnu.org. And as always, subscribe to the book club and the after hours at the book club podcast. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. My co-host, as always, Arson Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thank you, Arson, and thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Thank you.